Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and this is Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio as we go around the world to our listeners in New Zealand, Ireland, England, clear down in Alabama and across North America. It's great to have you all on board. We've got a fantastic show tonight. From the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Director of the National Conservation Training Center, in a little bit we'll be talking to Jay Slack. We've got a lot in common because he's a herpetologist and he spent a long time in the Everglades, so we're going to spend a few moments discussing the reptiles, the gators and snakes of the Everglades. This will be a good time tonight. And as always, manning the controls for us this week from Pennsylvania, Eric Altman. He will be manning the chat room as well as monitoring the phones, though I don't know if we'll take calls tonight. Boy, there's so much to talk with Jay about, but we'll see what happens. And of course, as always, bring us the Wild World News, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson.
So how's things in Indianapolis?
Well, tonight it's cooled off a little bit. We actually got the windows open here.
Well,
we're hoping it'll last for a little while. Next week we're in the 90s again. It's been pretty brutal here, just brutal.
Well, I'm glad you have the windows in the massive studios of the Dr. Henry Day broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis. It's great to have you on board. We want to remind everybody that Larry Batson's Wild World News is brought to you by, it's underwritten by Jet Kaiser Films. If you have a documentary that you want to produce, anything, he'll travel around the world, all in HD, all very professional. He's an artist in his own right. Go to his website, jetkaiser.com, and we appreciate him for underwriting the Wild World News. What have we got tonight, Doctor?
Well, we're going to start off in Barcelona, Spain. Now listen to this. Lawmakers in Catalonia outlawed bullfighting Wednesday, making it Spain's first major region to ban deadly centuries-old ballet between a matador and a beast.
Really?
After a debate that, pitted animal rights against a pillar of traditional culture. Bullfighting, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty unbelievable. Cheers broke out in the local 135-seat legislature after Speaker announced that the ban had passed 68 to 55. The ban will take effect in 2012 in the northeast coastal region, which is the capital is Barcelona.
Oh, okay. Well, that won't affect the running of the bulls, though, I assume.
No, probably, because the bulls win when
the
running
bulls,
the bulls
are. Well, the bulls do win.
Yeah.
That's definitely okay.
That's probably the fairness there. But, that's pretty major news there.
I'll bet.
All right. Chatham, Massachusetts. 10 officials are not closing any beaches, but are advising beachgoers to stay close to the shore and not swim near any seals following additional sightings of great white sharks.
Oh.
Yeah. A fisherman working under contract has attached a satellite tag to a 12 to 14-foot shark off a south beach. And a spotter plane has also spotted several sharks in the water.
Well, you know, we've discussed this in the past. In fact, Frank Mundus, who is basically the inspiration for the book and film Jaws, he's the real Quint. And God bless his soul, he's passed away. But they'd go on shark fishing, well, great white shark fishing expeditions, right off the coast of New York. And what I was always told that basically what they did is they took the folks out to the dump in the ocean, and that's where they caught the sharks. But,
Well, see, I'm a big fan of sharks because, God, they just taste so good.
You know, I have to confess, I've had shark before, and you know what? It tastes like fish, but the consistency is like steak.
Yeah.
And you're right.
But, I hate to admit that, but
I haven't had it in a long, long, long time, but I have to confess I did enjoy it.
All right, Augusta, Maine. The Department of Environmental Protection approved a plan to decommission the Howland Dam and build a fish bypass that will enable Atlantic salmon, shad, and other fish to migrate upstream. This is part of a $50 million plan to remove or bypass three dams on the Penobscot. Now, this opens nearly 1,000 miles of habitat to the sea-run fish.
Well, good for them.
That's unbelievable.
Yes, and I'm sure it was coordinated with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, without a doubt.
It was, without a doubt. Now, here I want everybody to listen to this story, Denver, Colorado. Now, this is Denver, but it's all over the United States. Chemicals found in household cleaners, detergents, fabric softeners are suspected of playing a role in the deaths of hundreds of ducks in the last few years. A study of the U.S. Geological Survey found chemicals may compromise ducks' ability to shed water off of their feathers. So basically what's happening, all these detergents and stuff, and they're taking the oil off of the feathers, and we're losing a lot of our fowl, our waterfowl. So, well, let's not use so much cleaners and detergents, fabric softeners, even though I do like my clothes soft. But that's pretty bad. That's pretty rude, isn't it? Mr. Batson?
Larry dropped off the line. We're trying to get him back on the air with us.
Okay, well, as long as we're still going, I'll just run along with the news.
I'm back.
All right.
Okay. I don't know what happened.
We decided that household detergents and cleaners, fabric softeners, are not good for the existence of our waterfowl.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I'm sure when we get Jay on here in a little bit, he'll absolutely agree with that. You know, he did a lot of research with frogs, and, of course, we know that the frogs are kind of the barometer of our natural world, so.
I love the frogs.
Yeah, well, he's done quite a bit of research with it, so we'll get into that, too. But, yeah, any of that yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's head off to New York now. This is a story close to your heart. It's a story from the past. Officials have a plan to trim the state's population of Canada geese to 85,000, down from an estimated 250,000. Yeah, the plan was developed after Canada geese disabled a U.S. Airways jet. Remember that? Forcing it to ditch in the Hudson.
All right.
The executive director of the New York City Audubon Society called the plan a little extreme.
A little what?
Extreme.
Oh. Well, you know, I have a good friend.
Well, yeah.
We're going to have him on the show one week, but he was responsible for reintroducing the Canadian geese back into Indiana, and we have a million of them now, so his program was rather successful.
Yes, it has.
And we know a lot of it has to do with the retention ponds and so forth that have been created, and the geese just don't leave.
Yeah. And the bad thing is they are so tough and so gamey, nobody really cares to prepare them, so there you go.
Yep, that's right.
All right, now I want everybody to listen to this story. New Orleans, Louisiana. Representatives of the state's seafood industry said that they are being hurt by false public perception about the safety of the region's seafood. University of Florida food science professor Steve Otwell said that the Gulf seafood is coming from government-approved waters and that the processes are in place to ensure that seafood is safe before it is sold.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, well, if you like seafood, continue to eat it. If there's a problem, the government will inform us as to such. But, you know, that, a lot of people depend on that, and they're in Louisiana and all along the coast there. And eat if you want some shrimp, have some shrimp.
That's right. You know, you watch what you eat all your life, and one day you walk in front of a truck. I mean,
yep,
what can we say?
Or a tree falls on you.
Or a tree falls on you, or you're whatever.
Yeah. Anchorage, Alaska.
Move on.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
The Alaska Zoo is babysitting a brown bear cub until state officials determine what facility outside the state will take it. Zoo workers said the cub arrived this week after it was rescued from the King Cove area. The 50-pound cub's sibling was killed by a male bear, and its mother ran off, possibly injured by the same bear.
Uh-huh.
So as we were talking just in the last few weeks about the mating season,
yes?
Beware.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And
you're out there.
I have two black bears, and, well, we don't have this problem anymore because he's been taken care of as far as his, you know. But in the month of June, he was aggressive. And I've always told folks that if you're in areas where bears are native, if you hear a clicking sound, that's the male bear. And they do several things. They make a clicking sound, and also they make a hoof. I call it a kind of not. It's not really a growl. It's a hoof. And when they walk, they actually slide their front feet, and they get very, very aggressive. So yeah, bears are tough. But one thing about the black bear, usually with a lot of noise and commotion and so forth, they'll take off. Your Kodiaks and grizzlies, that's a little different situation, but black bears are usually big chickens.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Because I know over the years, the black bears I've encountered at your place, they've, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, I hope you've heard about the turtle hatchings. They're releasing a bunch of little baby turtles into the Gulf. And one of our favorite places, Padre Island,
yep,
Texas. All right, well, the Kemp's Ripley turtles have been endangered since about 1973, and the U.S. and Mexico have been trying to protect them and work together to kind of rejuvenate the species. Well, Donna Shaver, chief of the Division of Turtle Science and Recovery at Padre Island, said that the turtles that they're releasing, they're kind of afraid to turn them loose in the Gulf because of the oil, you know, it's a big thing. But they say that the turtles need to walk through the sand of Padre Island to imprint themselves on the location so that they'll be able to return and nest there, you know, years later. So she's already released 7,000 to 8,000 hatchlings this year. And the process involves protecting the little hatchlings from the birds as they crawl, you know, from their nest to the sand and swim through the breakers. And the turtles will swim for a few days until they can reach some patches of seaweed where they'll kind of hide from the predators and until they can beef up a little bit.
But, hang on to that name, Doc, because we'll have her on the show. I'll get with her. We'll find out all the insides on this.
She says nature is calling them, and they need to get out there and be little turtles in their world.
That's right.
All right. Well, the animal news has carried on a little bit tonight, so let's finish it up with Salt Lake City, okay?
Okay.
All right. Well, we got prairie dogs that have been digging up a town cemetery in the southern part of the state are being evicted after complaints from officials that the animals are toppling headstones.
Oh,
yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah. Fence proved ineffective. So the trappers are coming in, and they're going to trap the prairie dogs, and they will be relocated.
I would hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, those little guys, they can do some damage. They sure are cute, though.
They sure are. So is that the Wild World News for tonight, Doctor?
Well, except for one more thing. I have something to ask you. I was talking to your wife last night, Cheryl.
Yes.
And she was telling me that Elizabeth, your baby baboon that does the school shows, is learning sign language.
Well, that's
from
what she claims.
From
watching television, yeah. Yeah. She also thinks it's learning Spanish, too, so... Que basa. You know what que basa is in Spanish, Doctor?
Yeah.
What is it?
Que pasa. Que pasa is what's happening, and que paso is what happened.
Yes?
That's all I know here.
Okay, all right. The Wild World News is underwritten by Chet Kaiser Films. Go to JetKaiser.com and find out all the latest technology and produce your documentary, your film, anything you want to do. Jet Kaiser's the guy you want to talk to, and we thank you. We also want to tell everyone that the Wild World, Larry Bassett's Wild World, is underwritten by We Want You Cottages way up in Chautauqua Lake, New York. They have an exciting new website called iKids Fishing where youngsters can submit that picture of that big whopper that they've caught, and it'll be compared to youngsters all across the country. That's at www.wewantyou.com. Also, a big thank you to McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado. And I'll tell you what, folks, Rocky Mountain National Park borders this magnificent McGregor Mountain Lodge, cabins, lodges. Oh, it's a place to stay. You'll have big orange sheep, elk in your backyard. It's fantastic. Go to their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com, or that 800 number at 1-800-835-8439. Also, a big thank you to Bass Pro Shops and Tracker Marine Boating Center down in Clarksville, Indiana. And that phone number is 812-218-5369. If you've never been to the Bass Pro Shops, it's an adventure in itself. While Dad checks out the latest fishing equipment, lures, and hunting equipment, his plans for his next great big expedition, the youngsters and a wife, and they can go look at these magnificent mounted animals, as well as their very impressive aquarium and see fish from all over North America. And also Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina, Lake Marion, Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes. They cover 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline. Known for world-class fishing, they hold 7 state records, 1 world record. So go to the website, www.santeecoopercountry.org, or call the girls. They'll plan your trip for you. They'll get your fishing guides, your motel, everything. 1-800-227-8510. Our guest tonight, boy, I'll tell you what, this is pretty impressive. We have with us tonight Jay Slack. He's the director of the National Conservation Training Center in beautiful Shepherdstown, West Virginia. He received a B.S. in biology in 1986 and an M.S. in ecology in 1988, both from Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois, where his academic research in herpetology centered on this speciation of rare frogs in the United States. Slack joined the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 1991 as a herpetologist in the agency's Phoenix, Arizona Ecological Service Office. In 1993, Jay moved to the Fish and Wildlife Service headquarters in Washington, D.C., where he became chief of its Endangered Species Listing Program. Very impressive, and coordinator of its endangered species with other federal agencies. He's also earned the fantastic award with the Department of Interior for Service Award in 2005. He's an avid motorcyclist. We'll talk about that, too. We'd like to welcome to the program tonight, Jay Slack. Hi, Jay.
Larry, thanks for having me on your show. I really appreciate being here.
Oh, man, I'll tell you what, I couldn't... Your credentials and your biography, I would have taken the whole show. I didn't realize all this stuff, but I should have known. You're the second director of the National Conservation Training Center, and what a spectacular facility that is.
Well, we enjoy what we do there at the National Conservation Training Center. We spend a lot of time thinking about how we're going to train the Fish and Wildlife Service and all of our conservation partners to do their job. And we have them in there and spend time teaching them their trade and learning from our partners. We really have an operation that's been a success over the last 12 or 13 years and really enjoy what we're doing.
I have to tell you, the very first time, and this is about 11 years ago when I went over there, I had no idea. In fact, Laura Jones had contacted me with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service because we were our good friend, old Jim Fowler from the old television show Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. They invited him to come over and speak for the open house, and, of course, they always say, bring your animals. Well, Jim doesn't really have animals, but he knows guys that are willing to load up their trucks and drive anywhere. So she said, come over here, and I think I got in about 2 o'clock in the morning. It was like you're going into Jurassic Park, these huge gates, and it was fantastic. And we had a mountain lion with us, and the place is a deer. You have to be careful driving through the facility because of all the deer. And I'll tell you what, that mountain lion, his attention was totally focused out that windshield as he watched all these deer. It was pretty funny.
That would be a slice of heaven for a mountain lion, I'm sure, with all the deer we have around there.
Oh, and the facility is just spectacular. You must have thought when you got that position that you say, man, this has to be a job from heaven.
Yes, it really is. I was really pleased when I heard that I would be able to take the job there, and I've enjoyed every minute of it since I've been there. Been there about 2 years now. We've got a great staff there, and never ceases to amaze me the things that we're doing and the people that we're bringing in and basically the learning that's going on there about conservation. It's really neat. You've been there, what,
yep,
every year now for 12 years?
Yeah, been every
right?
year. It's my second
yeah,
home.
Our open house and bring in your animals and
yep.
Cheryl comes along and, yeah, we really enjoy having you there, and I know that you've really become a local legend in the Shepherdstown area too. The local folks and especially the children like coming out and seeing what you have to show them and what you have to tell them each year. So we really appreciate you coming out there.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'll tell you what, we were there the first year when they dedicated that fantastic auditorium. The Robert Beard Auditorium, and God bless his soul, he just recently passed away. In fact, I believe it was about the time we were over there for the Student Climate Conservation Congress. It's around that time frame.
That's right. This year was our second Student Conservation Climate Conference.
What a spectacular event that is. I mean, and those youngsters, I mean, it makes you feel good that our future is in their hands because, boy, they seem to be right on top of it.
Well, they really know what's going on, and they are very much connected with conservation. They're very connected to their communities. Those schools communicate with one another, and the things that they accomplish, it's just truly amazing. And thinking about it, you know, when we were younger, I just don't see how we were connected like the kids of today with the internet and being able to share ideas and talk with one another so readily. It's just amazing what they can do.
Well, I know that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they have their own, you know, we talk about the NBA going into colleges and recruiting their players. I know the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, from this group of individuals, there was over 100 young people, college and high school age, that they're thinking, hey, this could be the future of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service because, as you know, Jay, the youngsters, they just don't go out like they used to, like when we were kids.
No, they really don't. But as far as being knowledgeable about the outdoors, mm-hmm. I think that they have more information available these days and perhaps as much passion, if not more, about conservation and about animals. So it's just a matter of connecting those folks with the outdoors, but most importantly, letting them know if they're interested in outdoor activities. There are also careers where you can do exactly what you love each day when you go to work, just like I have for the last 20 years. And let me tell you, when you're doing what you enjoy, it doesn't seem like work at all.
No, it doesn't. And I'll tell you what, that group of kids, I could see it in their face. Like I've always, I get, you know, people say, I want to do your job. Well, you may not want to do my job, but, you know, get your education, get your, like you did, Jay. You know, you've got your degrees, and look, and the world is at your footsteps. I mean, it's all in front of you. You know, you can basically pick wherever you want to go, I assume. I mean, if you wanted to take a position, go out to Yellowstone National Park or Glacier, or, though I know you spent a long time in the Everglades.
Yes, I did.
In fact,
it's been about 9 years.
Wow.
Go ahead, Larry.
No, I was going to say, when I was in your office when we were talking about our chat tonight, and you said that, which I wasn't aware of it till we were talking that afternoon, that you're a herpetologist and that you spent a long time in the Everglades. So I thought, well, that's our subject, I said, because that's probably one of my favorite places. And, of course, that's here lately, the attention that has been brought to the Everglades due to the introduction of many non-native species that have been able to survive in that world. Did you get a chance? Did you have a chance to see that when you were there?
Yeah, I really did. I was there for about 9 years, and went there in the mid 90s, and started down there working on Everglades restoration. But at the time, at that time, it was unknown, or there were not any pythons that had escaped and started breeding in the Everglades. And over the course of the 9 years I was there, basically it went from something we hadn't even thought about to an epidemic. And right now the number of invasive pythons of even different species that are in the Everglades has really become an issue. And it's an eye-opener to recognize that what might be good intentions, for instance, putting a python out in what seems like a good place to release them if they've become too big to be a good pet, can actually have some pretty dramatic consequences. And that's something not just in the Everglades, but that's something that we need to think about across the whole country, making sure that we keep the species that aren't supposed to be out there in the wild in captivity and make sure that they don't overrun the native species.
Well, I had seen something on television just a few days ago, and they were talking about, of course, the main culprit that they blame this on is Hurricane Andrew, and that there was a huge python breeding facility, which was essentially set up in, well, more or less just like a big tent. And when Hurricane Andrew came through, of course, it completely destroyed that and all the little plastic boxes that these baby pythons were in. And they said for years that they, well, I wouldn't say years, but a couple of years, they didn't even think about it. They didn't even see any until they started getting some size, of course. And now it's I don't know what they're probably guesstimating how many actually live in the Everglades. But they've developed a program to try and control those numbers, haven't they?
They have. They're certainly trying to capture those snakes. They're trying to limit the spread of the snakes. As a matter of fact, this has been a number of years ago, and I don't know if Python Pete is still in duty, but at one time they had trained dogs to help them find the snakes so they could get them out of the wild, and Python Pete was one of the dogs that I knew they had pioneered that concept with. It's a pretty good name, and I guess Pete was pretty good at finding the snakes, too.
You know, when I was collecting snakes here in Indiana, I had my wife Cheryl had a dog that I would always take snake collecting with me, because that it would find them. I mean, it would stop and stare at the ground and bark, and I'd go over there and we'd find timber rattlesnakes and milk snakes, and it was phenomenal. In fact, I felt guilty. It was so easy.
Yeah, that's amazing. Dogs have a keen sense of smell and probably senses that we aren't able to tap or certainly take for granted help them find all sorts of things. We know all about bloodhounds, but there's no reason why they can't find snakes and any other number of critters if you train them.
Well, Jay, you know, you're a herpetologist. I have a keen interest in reptiles. Let's go to the Everglades and catch pythons.
Hey, you know, that would be a pretty good pastime and something good to do for the environment, too. That would be okay.
Well, you know what I'd suggest?
We have a future there. I'm sure we do.
Well, you know what I had suggested, you know, because this has worked for so many different animals, it worked for the wolves, that they should just put a bounty on those snakes, and probably with a couple $1 million, and they'd probably be 80% taken care of.
Well, that certainly could potentially be one of the solutions.
Well.
Yeah.
It sounds like a good time to me, though.
Yeah, it does. Doesn't it? You can handle the big ones, like that big one that you brought out to the Conservation Training Center a couple of years ago. I'll find them, and you can catch them. How's that?
Well,
you know, being a herpetologist, snakes aren't exactly my favorite thing. I worked on frogs, so you can do the catching.
Well, the thing is, the bigger ones are the easier ones to handle. It's usually the little ones that you get nailed by, because you grab it by the tail and you got 8 or 9 foot of snake to negotiate. You grab a little one by the tail, you got about 2 feet. Before you know it, you got the head in your face. And what I have heard, Jay, is that the big problem with these pythons is the species, the African rock python.
Hmm.
And that's a whole different critter than the Burmese pythons. They're twice as aggressive. They grow quicker. And I've been told, and I've read that when these snake hunters run into these, it's a handful.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not surprising.
And of course, they have the reticulated pythons that are from Southeast Asia, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And those just grow huge. I mean, 28-foot snake in no time.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
A lot of snake.
Well, it's unbelievable. It's 200 or 300 pounds of snake. And the problem with that big is that it takes two or three guys that know what they're doing to be able to wrestle it and maneuver it and get it in a bag or however they're going to do it or whatever. But it sounds like a good time to me, Jay, so we should go.
Sounds like a good plan to me.
We're going to take a quick break here. We're going to be back with Jay Slack. We have a few PSA. You're listening to Blog Talk Radio, and this is Larry Batson's Wild World.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Pat Green. The blood supply is at critically low levels, and you can help. Call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. That's 1-800-GIVE-LIFE to schedule your appointment to donate blood. Your donation is critical because every 2 seconds someone in America needs blood. That's accident victims, surgical candidates, and cancer patients, just to name a few. Please donate blood and encourage your friends, family, and neighbors to give too. Please call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to make your appointment. Thank you.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at takemefishing.org.
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Kathy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Kathy? It's not a kitty, it's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters.
It's Bobcat, Abby. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean?
Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Danger at the Old Well.
Last one to the old well, the rotten egg. I win. Whoa! Sassy! Johnny fell down the well!
I'm wet!
What, Sassy? You know where Mr. Gunderson keeps his rope? Go get it, girl! What? You'd rather use this time to set people straight about shelter pet adoption?
I'm cold!
People shouldn't be afraid to adopt from a shelter? Because shelter pets are screened for sound, health, and temperament?
I'm wet and cold!
Sassy, what about Johnny? What? Let Johnny sit in the well until he learns to be more self-reliant? Sassy!
What'd he say?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
There are some visitors you'd just rather not see. Like your obnoxious brother-in-law, Louie.
Hey, everybody, we're here! Good to see you! When do we eat?
But then there are some visitors you just can't get enough of. To make your farm or ranch a more attractive place for the visitors you actually want to see, contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office. They can help you build the habitat wildlife loves. But as for Louie, try disconnecting the doorbell. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at takemefishing.org.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. We have a fantastic guest tonight, Jay Slack, with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's director of the National Conservation Training Center. I'll be back with us in just moments. We want to remind everyone that Larry Batson's Wild World is underwritten by We Want You Cottages way up in western New York. Chautauqua Lake, if you're going to plan a great vacation, man, I'll tell you what, the musky fishing, smallmouth, walleye, that's where you want to go. They have fantastic facilities, boats, guides, it's all there. Here's their number, 716-789-3383, or go to their website, wewantyou.com. Also, be sure you check out the iKids Fishing. That's where youngsters can download photographs of that big fish they caught and compare it with youngsters all across the country. Also, a big thank you to McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado. I know Jay spent some time in Colorado. We ought to talk about that. And on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park, and if you've never been out there, folks, you've got to go at least once in your lifetime. It's absolutely spectacular. But the McGregor Mountain Lodge is where you want to stay. They've got a great group of cabins and the lodge, and it's just fantastic. Their website is info@McGregorMountainLodge.com, and their phone number is 1-800-835-8439. In fact, Michael Hodges is going to be on the program in the next few weeks. He's the proprietor, but also he's a fantastic mountaineer, and we're going to be talking about some of the adventures he's gone on in those magnificent Rocky Mountains. Also, the Bass Pro Shop and the Tracker Marine Boating Center down in Clarksville, Indiana. Big thank you to Dan White. Their phone number is 812-218-5369. And if you've never been to the Bass Pro Shops before, anywhere in the country, they're absolutely spectacular. You want to be sure you check those out if you're an outdoorsman. Also, my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. It tells all about our wildlife education work that we do, our wild animal rescue, and also our brand-new children's book, Alphabet Swamp. You can pick up a copy through our website. It's LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. And also, Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina, Lake Marion and Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes. You ever been fishing there before, Jay?
No, I haven't. I sure would like to go, though.
Well, let me tell you. It's 171,000 acres on 450 miles of shoreline. And when you go out fishing with these guys, there's one guy, in fact, he's going to be on the program. He's an old Cajun from Louisiana, Boudreaux. And they take you out in these boats, and the lake basically looks like an ocean. And they put seven or eight poles out, and they get in these massive, monstrous blue cats. And and they tell you. Now, when that rod tip just kind of moves, that's just the waves. But when he says that rod tip heads to the water and jerks, his words, violently, grab the pole and jerk as hard, and you may have anything from 10 to 60, 70, 80 pounds. And it's an adventure.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It's a blast. Their phone number is 1-800-227-8510. They will plan your whole trip. Tell the girls, I want to go fishing. They'll fix you up with a guide, the place to stay, the boats, everything. Or their website, www.santeecoopercountry.org. Or if you're a golfer, that's a fantastic place to go golfing as well. But we thank all of our underwriters. Jay, we were talking earlier. You know, your expertise in herpetology. In fact, I think I screwed up the pronunciation of this earlier, but it's the speciation of rare frogs in the United States. Now, what exactly was involved when you were doing that research?
Well, this research basically was taking a look at a number of species and subspecies in the Midwest and then also in the East and the West. They are chorus frogs. And so the theory was when the glaciers came down in the Pleistocene about 10,000 years ago, those species of frogs had to migrate to the south to escape the cold from the glaciers. Mm-hmm. And while they were down there sort of in literally geologic time, they had enough time that they separated into species distinct from one another. And then as the glaciers receded back up into the north and it became warmer, they slowly recolonized the area. And when they did and got back into the Midwest, they'd been separated so long that they were actually different subspecies because of being apart so long. And what I was doing was taking a look at the way that the species would use their mating calls to find mates. And indeed, the mating calls were different, and genetically they'd become different enough that they were actually not interbreeding, and they'd become species because of the glaciers. Pretty interesting stuff, really.
Wow. So if you go to an area and you can hear the frogs calling, can you identify the various species?
Definitely. The different calls are distinguishing of each of the species. And in fact, when the frogs are looking for a mate, they know exactly not necessarily know other species, but they know the call of their species, and they go to that call.
I'll tell you what happens here. We have, in the spring, we have our alligator facility. Of course, early spring, we don't have them out yet until the weather gets a little bit warmer. But it was pretty wild because the wife and I would hear these chattering sounds, and at first I almost thought it was sound like baby raccoons. And we realized it was wood frogs.
Really?
Yeah, and every year, every spring, in these ponds that we've, concrete ponds that we've built for the alligators, they're there like clockwork. You'll hear them chattering. Of course, when we put the alligators out for the summer, they leave. I mean, they're gone.
Probably don't like to stick around.
No.
They probably don't know what to think of alligators in Indiana, though, do they?
It's probably, you know, I've always had this weird theory that tens of thousands of years from now, if some archaeologists or paleontologists go digging around this area that we now live, that they're going to come across animals that we've laid to rest thinking, well, I never had any idea that the Bengal tiger was indigenous to Indiana.
Right. They'll have to come up with some sort of a scientific theory to figure that one out.
I don't know.
Scientific oddities. I and I wondered if Dr. Day would talk about this in his news.
Yeah.
This week in the news, have you heard of an animal called a Z-donk?
A what?
No. A Z-donk.
Oh, a Z. Oh, yeah.
I had never heard of one, and I saw it was in the news this week. One was born in Georgia, and it's a cross between a donkey and a zebra. The father was a zebra, and the mother was a donkey. I saw the picture of it. It looks like a donkey from the body up, but it has zebra legs, black stripes. They named it Pippi Longstocking.
They did. Well, you know, they've been doing that for a number of years. In fact, I believe down in the I'm sure you had a chance to maybe you didn't get to know some of the local animal folks in Florida. I believe in Naples there was a fella named Jungle Larry. Now, he was well known for breeding tigers and lions, and they called them Tigalons.
Yeah.
And basically, you had a big lion that had faint stripes on it. And, you know, it has no purpose except to draw visitors into a roadside attraction in Florida. In fact, he was out in Naples. And basically, that's what the Z-donk, in fact, there's, believe it or not, there's an actual, it's called the Animal Finder's Guide, where you can buy all these, well, you can buy anything, basically, as far as legally, I mean, as far as that they can sell legally. But I've seen the Z-donks on there before. And, in fact, I had a good friend that moved a lot of livestock, and he actually, when they moved zebras, they would put he had this one particular donkey that he'd put in with the zebras to keep them calm, because they're very hyper. Sure. But, yeah. And it was, it's like the pythons now. They've bred all these unusual species together and so forth, and it's just, in fact, you know, Jay, have you ever been to one of what they call these reptile shows?
I have not, to tell you the truth. I just had never really done that.
Well, if you ever have a chance, I don't know in your area. I'm sure they have them in Hagerstown or Washington. If you ever see one advertised, you should just go to just check it out. Because they had one here in Indianapolis years ago, and I saw thousands of ball pythons that these various breeders have bred in captivity. And I'm thinking to myself, there's not enough people to own all these snakes. I mean, where are they going to go?
Well, it's a popular thing. Reptiles as pets, very popular. And they actually do make good pets, especially the captive-reared ones.
Well, yeah, and that, like I've always, I can remember the years ago where everything was basically brought out of the wild from Asia and Africa and so forth, and those are the days of, oh my God, you'd get specimens in that would have health problems from that there's no way you could ever anticipate. But now, I totally agree that now that they've bred them in captivity, that it's a whole different ball game. But I'll tell you what,
from an ecological standpoint, you know, capturing them from the wild is not the best thing to do, especially when there's so many that are captive bred, and they do make good pets. And leaving the ones that are out there in the wild is the right thing to do.
Absolutely. I've always thought that. And it's just, between that and also the raising and breeding of parrots in the United States, where, as you know, years ago they were just basically, they were tens of thousands of parrots and macaws were crammed in little tight containers, and they would hope that 50% would make the trip from wherever, the Brazil, the Amazon, to Florida. It was just so sad. And, of course, when the Newcastle disease came through, the threat to the poultry industry, and then that was all cut off. And for years, you know, parrots were quite valuable. Now, of course, the value's come down quite a bit in what we call the pet trade. But it's definitely a thing for the better. You're involved with these dangers. Go ahead.
Well, just in this day and age, I think the captive breeding programs that are around produce far better animals, and the whole concept of bringing them in from the wild across, you know, across the ocean, and it's not good for the animals, and they don't make perhaps as good a pet as the captive reared individuals. So I really think that's the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. When you were involved with the Endangered Species Listing Program, what did that actually entail? What was your responsibilities?
Well, I worked in the Washington office at that time, mm-hmm. and our agency, the Fish and Wildlife Service, has a responsibility for making sure that species that need to be protected by the Endangered Species Act get put on that list of endangered species and have those protections, like the bald eagle got, and then, you know, the conservation that went on for the bald eagle got to the point where it didn't need necessarily the protections under the Endangered Species Act that it had, and was a success. We're trying to do that with the other species that need some protection. In the Washington office, we would get the proposals in from our biologists out in the field, and they would do an analysis and say whether or not we thought that species needed to be put on the list to get the protection. We would, at that point, go through a regulatory process, take comments from the public, make sure that the science was absolutely correct and was the best science that was possible, and go ahead and put them on the list and get them that protection, and then we'd start working on getting them off of the list, take care of the problems, whether it was loss of habitat, some disease, like you pointed out, sometimes some disease come into populations. We'd figure out what the problems were and see if we could work with folks that could help make sure we get rid of those problems and try to get the numbers back up and take them off the list.
Would you say that the bald eagle is the greatest success?
Well, I think there are a number of successes, but certainly what's happened with the bald eagle population in the lower 48 United States is phenomenal. We took care of some of the problems that we saw with BDT and the effects that it had on their ability to lay eggs that were durable enough to hatch. Also, you know, poisoning of the eagles that was occurring from various poisons. The numbers over the actually fairly few years that we had them on the endangered species list skyrocketed, and now it's, you know, not uncommon to see bald eagles when you're out. I remember when I was a kid, it was true in Illinois, it was truly, truly a rare thing to ever see a bald eagle. And you know, in most places in the United States, it's not rare at all now.
No. We've got an eagle nest just down the road from our place.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, that may be one of the first bald eagles I ever had a chance to see.
They're fantastic animals. They're at the National Conservation Training Center in Shepherdstown. We actually have a pair of bald eagles that nest each year, and they have for the last 7 years, I think. And we actually have a camera in the tree that points down into the nest, and we watch them do their courtship. We watch them lay their eggs. You can get online on our website and see the eaglets as they're being reared. You can see the parents come in and feed them fish. It's a fantastic thing. That website at the National Conservation Training Center gets a huge amount of traffic all year round, but especially when those young eagles are in there. It's fantastic. And certainly that's something I'd encourage folks to take a look at. There aren't eagles in there, young eagles in there right now. They've actually fledged. The one eagle that they had this year fledged. But you can still take a look in the nest and also look on our website and see some of the photographs that have been taken over the years. And you can get to that website by going to the Fish and Wildlife Service's homepage, and it's www.fws.gov, FWS like Fish and Wildlife Service, and then you can click on the training icon on the left-hand side, which takes you to the National Conservation Training Center. And on our main site, you'll see where you can click on and take a look at the web camera. And while folks are there, certainly I encourage folks to learn about the Fish and Wildlife Service and the programs that we have and learn more about what we do. So please come and take a look at our site.
Well, it's a fantastic site. In fact, I've spent, when we've been over there in the beautiful lodges that we stay in, that I've watched the Eagle Camp more than I've watched the regular television, I have to confess. It's usually a greater entertainment value, so it's like... But I was
certainly told, there's something going on in there all the time.
But I was told that mom or dad brought in something to feed the babies one time that caused a little bit of a furor. Do you know what I'm referring to?
No, actually, I'm not.
Well, I won't.
They are. Let's just say they are generalists in what they would bring in to feed. Including probably reptiles.
Well, I think it was more like kitty.
Somebody's sure about that.
Yeah, I don't know, but I was I was probably just a vicious rumor. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you know, they are wild animals, so.
Well, certainly they do tend to focus on fish, but.
There was a turkey farm not too far from here, and I can still remember the one eagle that would show up at the turkey farm every day and walk amongst the turkeys. And they finally figured out that it was feeding on turkey carrion. So,
really?
Yeah, it was quite the attraction. And then, of course, the eagles that we have down here, one of the elementary teachers decided to put it on the website, so it became a tourist mecca. And there would be dozens of people down there parked around the eagle nest, and they don't care. I mean, they get so blasé about it. I mean, we have big gravel trucks that go up and down that road, and the eagles, they just look at it, and they're not a bit intimidated or frightened or anything about it. So I don't know.
Well, they're large animals, and they don't have very many predators, and no doubt they are very robust and can take care of themselves. It's no wonder they ended up being the national symbol.
Well, and you know the old story, old Benjamin Franklin wanted to make it the turkey. I am so glad that did not happen, because we've discovered maybe the turkey is
the eagle is probably
far more noble and much much more So you've been at the National Conservation Training Center now for 2 years, Jay. What In your mind, what moment in your tenure that you said, "Wow, this job is just too cool"?
Well, I have a moment like that, if not every day, at least once or twice a week. But I'll tell you, the thing that really strikes me is when we have the groups of kids in there or the young adults in there, like you'd mentioned, the student climate conference. And we have our open house each year where we bring in kids from all over the country, but we also particularly kids around the area. And to see them learn about animals and to see them learn about conservation, that's what truly amazes. So I am continued to be amazed at kind of the wonderment I see in their eyes when they come out there.
Well, it's a truly spectacular place. In fact, I want to tell everybody, anyone in that area around the Shepherdstown, Washington, D.C., Hagerstown, you know, drive all day. It's worth it. The open house will be the last, I believe you said it's going to be the last weekend in October this year.
Yes, in October.
30th. Yeah, the 30th.
Yeah.
And our plans, as far as we know, is we're going to be over with animals. But besides that, the whole facility and the various activities that go on, it's just a very impressive day, very impressive. And you guys just do a spectacular job with it.
Yeah, we really enjoy the open house, and folks love coming out there. So I'm really looking forward to it this year and looking forward to seeing you again as well.
Well, and Jay, we should talk about our trip to the Everglades. We'll go down there and wrestle snakes.
Are you gonna have to get a motorcycle and ride a motorcycle back to Florida like you told me you did one time?
Well, God, that was brutal. No, you're quite the motorcyclist, but you should really get a bigger bike than a 400 Honda to ride to Florida. I was just young and dumb and didn't know any better, and you know how that is. But anyway. Yeah. Jay, we want to thank you for being on the program. Gosh, such an important individual to take the time this hour to chat with us, and I know our listeners around the world thoroughly enjoyed it, and you're a real class act. We really appreciate you being on tonight.
Well, Larry, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it, and hopefully we'll be able to cross paths here soon and talk about that trip to the Everglades.
I certainly hope so. Next week on our program, we're going to have from the Department of Natural Resources right here in the state of Indiana, longtime conservation officer Dave Windsor. We're going to talk about some of his adventures as he basically fights to save the wildlife of Indiana and some of the things that go on in his vast career of over 20 years with the Department of Natural Resources. We want to thank all of our underwriters. We want to thank Eric Altman over in Pennsylvania for taking over the technical responsibilities tonight. Of course, as always, Dr. Henry Day for the Wild World News. Have a great week, everybody. I'm glad you tuned in. Remember, put us on as one of your friends on Blog Talk Radio. This is Larry Batson, and you've been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.